Month here at Henry Ford College and here on WHFR with a special presentation that was given earlier this month. Took place last week, Tuesday, February 7th. Presentation called It Happened in Detroit: Amazing Underground Railroad Stories. This virtual presentation was presented by retired Grand Valley State University professor Dr. Vita Smith, where she tells some of the exciting stories of the contributions that Detroiters and Canadians made during the struggle against slavery before and after the 13 colonies became the United States, and when Michigan was both a French, a British, and eventually an American territory. The presentation was sponsored by the African American Association and the Office of Student Activities. As mentioned, Dr. Vita Smith Tucker is a retired Grand Valley State University professor and also a proud auntie to the person who's going to introduce her for the presentation, and that would be from HFC's English department, Mr. Paul Rogers. Let's listen to it now here on today's WHFR Journal.
A little bit about Dr. Tucker. Dr. Tucker is an educator, writer, and literary and public historian with more than 30 years of teaching experience. She's published articles and books on historical fiction written by late 19th and 20th century African-American women on antebellum African-American settlement in southwestern Michigan, and on the Underground Railroad emancipation through Michigan and abolitionistic activism from Michigan into Canada, which is very interesting because that's going to be the focus of her talk today. Throughout her career as an English professor, she's dedicated her career to helping students improve their literacy skills, their critical thinking competencies, and their understanding of African-American and American history. For today's event, Dr. Tucker is joining us to retell some of the exciting stories of the contributions that Detroiters and Canadians made to the 13 colonies that became the United States. We thank you so much for joining us again, Dr. Tucker. The floor is yours.
Okay, thank you for that introduction. And I want to thank the African American Student Association for this invitation, as well as the Office of Student Activities at Henry Ford, Ms. Fluker, and my nephew, Paul Rogers. It is a pleasure to be here again and to talk to you about some of Detroit's history and to revisit some of the daring rescues that people on both sides of the Detroit River staged when they were struggling to defeat American slavery. Now, my nephew mentioned to you, I'm going to share the screen so you can see some slides. You see two monuments. One is in Detroit along the river in Hart Plaza, and the other is in Windsor. It's the two monuments face each other. But these are Underground Railroad monuments that were placed there to pay tribute to champions for freedom in Detroit and Canada who put themselves in danger to help men, women, and children break the chains that harnessed them to slavery. If you haven't seen these two monuments, put it on your list to do, to go and see these two monuments. They are very impressive. Actually, the one in Hart Plaza was done by an African-American sculptor by the name of Ed Dwight. So this Detroit River collaboration started very early, long before the people depicted in these statues were born, and long before any of them came to Detroit. So we need to go way back in time to Detroit when it was just a fur trading post in the frontier days. This is a drawing that an artist did of the Detroit River in 1794. Now, you know, in 1794, we didn't have cameras. There was no photography. So all of the images that we have at this period of time were done by hand drawings. And these early drawings of Detroit are very interesting because they always show Detroit as a little shoreline village, and everything is very, very peaceful. The water is very tranquil. You see birds just kind of winging their way over the water. But the people who lived in Detroit did not experience it as a peaceful place. It was a large fort that was surrounded by a stockade, and the people lived inside the walls near the fort. And the reason why they lived inside the walls near the fort was because they were surrounded by hostile Native Americans, because the fort was built on Native American land. And when the fort was originally built by the French traded items produced in Europe for animal furs that the Native Americans trapped. So for the first 50 years, beginning in 1701, the fort that Cadillac established at Detroit was part of the French Empire in the West. So France actually occupied more land in North America than the British did. And so that caused competition, hostilities. And so the French and the British went to war over the land. From 1755 until 1763, France and England and their respective Native American allies fought over the land that the French claimed. But when France and its Native American allies lost the war, France had to vacate all of its fur trading forts along the Mississippi River, all the way up to Hudson Bay in Canada, and all the way down to Louisiana, including, of course, the fort at Detroit. During that war, Native Americans who were allies of the French raided settlers' farms in the southern colonies. On one Chippewa raid into Virginia, a young boy's family became a spoil of war. Young William Tucker's mother and father were killed, and 12-year-old William was captured, brought back to a Chippewa village in Michigan Territory, and adopted by a Chippewa family. So William's formative years were spent in a Chippewa village as a Chippewa boy. Now, William Tucker is no relation to me. I want to get that out there right away. But he lived as a Chippewa boy from the time he was 12 until the time he was about 18. When he became an adult, the Chippewas rewarded him with thousands of acres of land along the Clinton River in what is now Macomb County. After acquiring this land, Tucker had a farmhouse built. Then he went back to Virginia and married a childhood friend by the name of Catherine and brought her back to his land in Michigan Territory. And then there was another war, the American Revolutionary War, when the American patriots fought the British from 1776 to 1781. In this particular war, William Tucker took the side of the British, and he served as an asset to the British because he was fluent in the Chippewa language. But the British lost the Revolutionary War. But William Tucker didn't lose. When the British had to hand over the fort at Detroit to the Americans, William Tucker was allowed to keep hundreds of acres of land that the Chippewas had given him. Tucker was a little over the age of 40 at the end of the Revolutionary War, and he knew what he needed to do to support his wife and family. So he set out turning his land into a profitable farm. In 1780, he did what men of European descent could easily do. He became a slave owner. He bought a woman named Hannah to help his wife manage the farm household, and he purchased a man named Peter Dennison to do the farm work. Peter Dennison was an extraordinary enslaved man. So the rest of this first story is about Peter Dennison and his family. Well, first of all, Peter Dennison is exceptional because it is extremely rare for an enslaved person at that time to have a European first and last name. Most enslaved people at that time only had one name, and even later, they only had one name. So this immediately prompts a series of questions that should have been easy to answer. There weren't that many people in the colonies at that time. How many of them were Dennisons, and where did they live? Unfortunately, these questions have never been answered. And due to the lack of research, Peter Dennison's birthplace and his origins are unknown. But what we do know is that Tucker's enslaved man, Peter, and woman, Hannah, eventually lived as husband and wife on Tucker's farm, and they had children. And we know that the Dennisons and their children helped William Tucker become a very wealthy man. In 1805, before his death at the age of 65, William Tucker had his last will written. These very bad copies that you see in this particular slide are actual copies of pages of William Tucker's will that was written in 1805. I was able to actually put my hands on these documents. And there's an inventory that runs 10 handwritten pages. And it includes things such as bushels of wheat, corn, rye, and potatoes, clothing, linens, furniture, silver, dishes, tools, 2 horses, 2 oxen, 9 goats, 1 bull, sheep, hogs, cattle, and 1 Negro man and woman with 4 children. They are listed as part of his inventory of property, his possessions. All of his worldly possessions he gave to his wife, Catherine, and to his children upon Catherine's death. Tucker owned so much property that reading the list of his possessions is almost hypnotizing until the very last page, where a surprising gift is given to Peter and Hannah. And it reads like this, and you can't see it, but that large circle actually is this page. It says, "I, William Tucker, having signed the former part of my last will and testament, have determined and do give to my black man and woman, namely Peter and Hannah, his wife, their freedom. After the decease of Catherine Tucker, my wife, provided they shall behave themselves as becometh to her during her life." Unquote. Now, Peter and Hannah must have served Tucker very well to be granted their freedom. But Tucker's gratitude did not extend to the Dennison children. So gaining freedom was a bittersweet victory for Peter and Hannah. because they could not take their children with them. Maybe due to their age, Catherine Tucker released Peter and Hannah from her service and indentured them to Elijah Brush. Elijah Brush was the Attorney General of the Territory of Michigan. So Peter and Hannah left the Tucker firm and went to work for 1 year for Elijah Brush. After 1 year of working for Brush, Catherine released Peter and Hannah completely, and they could take full advantage of their freedom. Now, Elijah Brush must have been very impressed with the Denisons as well, because he recommended Peter Denison to the governor of Michigan, William Hull. In 1806, when Governor Hull organized a black militia to defend Detroit from marauding Indian ambushes, Governor Hull made Peter Denison commander of the militia unit, which was quite an honor for a formerly enslaved man. While serving as commander of the black militia, patrolling outside the fort, Denison had time to think about what he could do to protect his children from being enslaved for the rest of their lives. The plan he came up with relied on his faithful service to William Tucker, to Elijah Brush, and to Governor Hull. Denison asked Elijah Brush to file a lawsuit in the name of his four children against their owner, Catherine Tucker, pleading for their release from slavery. Now, this was tricky, and Brush and Denison knew it was tricky, but they had the law on their side. After the Revolutionary War, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 made Michigan officially part of the Northwest Territory. But the law also mandated that slavery was not allowed in the Northwest Territory. But as always, there was a loophole. Exceptions were made for British settlers who had lived in the territory before it officially became American land. Those British settlers could retain all the property they owned before the war, including their enslaved human property. This was the basis of the argument that Catherine Tucker's lawyer presented at the Denison's trial. The judge who heard the case was Judge Augustus B. Woodward. Yes, Woodward Avenue is named after this judge. He was the first Supreme Court judge in Michigan, and he was appointed by President Thomas Jefferson. So Judge Woodward knew the law. He was sent to Michigan to administer the law. But surprisingly, he decided the case in Catherine Tucker's favor. This meant that three of the Denison children would have to spend the rest of their lives in slavery. In order to prevent his children from spending their lives in slavery, Peter Denison pursued the only solution available to him, escaping to Canada. To gain his children's freedom, he would have to forfeit the rewards he was going to earn from his service as a military commander. And he would have to reject and forfeit his new political status as a free U.S. citizen. Denison's actions reveal his self-determination, his desire for freedom, and dignity for himself and his children, and his profound understanding of geopolitics of the Detroit River borderland, even though he was not able to read or write. In the next few months, under a cloak of secrecy, Dennison removed his children from the Tucker farm, and they all crossed the Detroit River to live in Upper Canada, where Canada's 1793 law to prevent the further introduction of slaves granted the Dennison children lifetime freedom because no new enslaved people could be brought into Canada. This was the exact opposite of what was legal for them in Detroit. In spite of the Northwest Ordinance, British settlers who remained on U.S. land after the Revolutionary War were permitted to retain their enslaved human property. So, yes, there were slaves in Detroit and in the Northwest Territory. Peter Dennison's actions at this time opened the floodgates to what eventually became a tsunami of blacks exiting the United States, seeking freedom and political recognition of their personhood in Canada. Elijah Brush, the Dennison's attorney, most likely assisted the Dennison's in their escape to Canada. Elijah Brush was the son-in-law of a wealthy fur trader and slaveholder and former British Detroiter named John Askin. During their time in Canada, the Dennisons attended St. John's Anglican Church in Sandwich. John Askin was a member of St. John's, and Angus McIntosh, another wealthy fur trader and former British settler from Detroit, also attended St. John's Church. All the Dennisons are believed to have found employment in the homes of Askin, McIntosh, and other British loyalists in Canada. There is never any evidence that the Dennison parents or the children were able to read or write. But that disability did not diminish their pride or their aspirations for freedom and dignity. On his death notice, recorded in 1812 by the pastor of St. John's Church, Peter Dennison Sr. was described, quote, as a Negro servant of Angus McIntosh. The Dennison's membership at St. John's Church helped them establish contacts with congregations back in Detroit. But they did not return to Detroit for almost a decade because there was another war, the War of 1812. The first evidence we have of the Dennison's return to Detroit is a marriage contract between Scipio Dennison and Charlotte Paul, performed by the Detroit Justice of the Peace in 1816. Back in Detroit, Elizabeth, the Dennison's oldest child, found employment in the home of Solomon Sibley, another prominent Detroit attorney. In 1825, Sibley helped Elizabeth purchase 48 acres of land from Stephen Mack in the village of Pontiac. With that purchase, Elizabeth Dennison became the first African American to purchase land in the village of Pontiac. The city of Pontiac has now recognized Elizabeth Dennison by commissioning a 40-foot mural painting of her on a building downtown. This spring, there will be a formal dedication of the mural and a historical marker placed at the site. And yours truly, Vita Tucker, will attend the ceremony because I worked with the city historian to create the sign that tells some of Elizabeth Dennison's incredible story. I could continue talking about the remarkable legacy that Elizabeth Dennison left in Michigan, but that's a topic for another presentation. Let me get back to the Underground Railroad in Detroit, where you're going to learn more fantastic Underground Railroad episodes.
That was part one of our presentation today on the WHFR Journal, a virtual presentation given last week, Tuesday, February 7th. It happened in Detroit. Amazing Underground Railroad Stories. Our speaker for the hour is retired Grand Valley State University professor, Dr. Vita Smith Tucker. We'll continue in just a moment with her presentation when we come back here on today's WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek.
Do you like the sound of a jazzy big band? How about something operatic? Maybe something lighthearted.
I'm feeling too good today. I'm feeling the way I shouldn't. I'm feeling too good today.
Hear them all on Big Band Broadway and Beyond. I'm Joe, your host, every Friday from 10 a.m. till noon on WHFR 89.3.
Do you want to make waves? Come join us at WHFR 89.3. WHFR is an award-winning, independent, non-commercial broadcast internet and radio station powered by over 50 student and volunteer staff members. WHFR provides classical 24 programming nightly and Mountain Stage weekly, while also airing weekly local public affairs and specialty talk programming. Come join us, making waves today.
Welcome back to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. I'll be with you until 2 o'clock this afternoon. At that time, we turn things over to Kitty Love, who takes us for a drive down Highway 61. Some blues for our Friday afternoon here on WHFR, Making Waves. We're going to continue on our program next with the rest of the presentation from Dr. Vita Smith Tucker, retired Grand Valley State University professor, a Black History Month presentation which took place last week Tuesday, 10 days ago on the 7th of February here at Henry Ford College. Well, not at Henry Ford College. It was held virtually via Zoom. Anyway, the presentation is called It Happened in Detroit, Amazing Underground Railroad Stories, exciting stories of the contributions that Detroiters and Canadians made during the struggle against slavery. This presentation was sponsored by the African American Association and the Office of Student Activities, and as is usually the case, although the original presentation went a little bit over an hour when it was given last week Tuesday, we had to trim it down to fit our 1 hour time slot here on WHFR Making Waves. And as always, we did everything to keep the integrity of the content intact and of the utmost quality. Anyway, we continue now with this presentation from Dr. Vita Smith Tucker. It Happened in Detroit, Amazing Underground Railroad Stories, celebrating Black History Month here on the WHFR Journal.
By the 1830s, a small group of economically independent African Americans had left slavery and their birthplaces in the South behind and established themselves in Detroit. There were many new African Americans in Detroit, but those that we know best are Madison Lightfoot and his wife, Tabitha. They were born in Virginia. George French and his wife, Caroline, who were born in Kentucky. And Deborah and Benjamin Willoughby, who were also born in Kentucky. But they were free when they came to Detroit. Benjamin Willoughby owned a successful lumber yard in Detroit. He was what today we call a loan shark because he loaned money with interest to black and whites in Detroit. Anyway, these new Detroiters were the backbone of an 1833 Underground Railroad conspiracy. The conspiracy began in Kentucky, where in June of 1831, an attractive young enslaved woman named Lucy was sold to a slave trader. And the slave trader was sure to get a handsome sum of money for Lucy because she looked good enough to be sold to New Orleans as a fancy girl. I'll tell you what that means later if you don't know what that means. But Lucy was already spoken for. She and an enslaved man named Thornton Blackburn considered themselves husband and wife. Knowing what would happen with Lucy if she were ever sold, Lucy and Thornton must have been planning to escape for some time, because within a month of her sale, she and Thornton escaped from Louisville in broad daylight. But that's because they were dressed in fine clothing. They had forged freedom papers, and they had tickets to board a steamboat out of Louisville heading for Ohio, a free state. After landing in Cincinnati, the Blackburns continued north by stagecoach to Detroit. They evaded their owners who were trying to catch up with them because of the rowdy crowds during the 4th of July celebrations. So it was very shrewd of them to leave during the 4th of July celebrations. The Blackburns had enough money to settle in Detroit while Thornton found work, and they were befriended by the Lightfoots, the Frenches, and the Willoughbys. But 1 year after their escape, someone from Louisville recognized Thornton on the street in Detroit. And in June of 1833, 2 years after they escaped, an agent of their owners filed a complaint in the Wayne County Court demanding Lucy and Thornton be returned to their owners. Now, according to the U.S. Fugitive Slave Law of 1793, enslavers could pursue their human property wherever they had escaped to in the U.S. And anyone who helped the runaway could be prosecuted, fined, and jailed. Courts in free states had to obey this law, and officers in free states had to help the enslavers recover runaways. So the Blackburns were apprehended and taken to jail. During their trial, blacks from Detroit and surrounding towns packed the balcony of the courthouse. When the judge ruled in favor of the enslavers, because he had to follow the law, the angry people in the balcony vowed to set the city on fire. Lucy and Thornton were taken back to the city jail and locked in cells to wait for the next steamboat heading south. The night after the trial, a secret meeting was held at the Willoughbys' home, and a plot was hatched to spring the Blackburns from the city jail. On the afternoon of Sunday, June 16th, Mrs. Lightfoot and Mrs. French visited the jail, still dressed in their Sunday clothes. The women asked to visit Lucy in her cell to offer her comfort and prayer. Mrs. Lightfoot and Mrs. French prayed with Lucy till evening. They finally left the jail after dark, weeping into their handkerchiefs, their veils covering their tear-stained faces. The next morning, the jailer discovered that the woman in the cell, the jail cell, was not Lucy Blackburn. It was Caroline French, dressed in Lucy's clothing. And Lucy could not be found anywhere in Detroit, because overnight, Lucy had been rowed across the Detroit River to safety in Canada. Embarrassed by Lucy's escape, the jailers decided to remove Thornton from the jail and put him on the steamboat in chains to wait for its departure on the boat. Monday afternoon, Thornton was brought to the door of the jail in chains, closely guarded by the sheriff, the jailer, and one of the Kentucky slave catchers. Just after they appeared outside, they saw a heavily armed crowd of men and women, young and old, whites and blacks, marching straight up Gratiot Street and stopped right in front of the jail. When the Kentuckians and the jailer saw the armed crowd, they ran back inside the jail, leaving Sheriff Wilson to face the crowd alone with Thornton. Someone in the crowd tossed Thornton a pistol, and he fired up in the air. The crowd surged forward, and as we say today, all hell broke loose. Sheriff Wilson was badly beaten. Thornton was seized, ankle chains and all, and dragged to a wagon. The wagoner reined the horses to a gallop and took off on a wild ride through the woods surrounding the waterfront. But determined not to let Thornton get away, the jailer found a cart and some hunting dogs and tried to follow Thornton's cart. With the jailer's dogs barking in the distance, Thornton was pulled from the cart and his ankle chains were hacked off. To throw the jailer off, the cart that had picked Thornton up was driven in the opposite direction, away from the riverfront, while Thornton and seven men fled on foot straight to the riverfront, where a boat was waiting to take all of them to Canada. That maneuver worked. By the time the jailer made it back to the riverfront, the boat carrying Thornton and seven fugitives was faintly visible near the Canadian shore. This went down in history as the Blackburn Riots of 1833. But today, very few people beside Detroit historians know about it. I've always wanted to see these events on screen as a film. I don't know if it would be a comedy or a tragedy, because it has elements of both. But even though the Blackburns evaded their Kentucky slave catchers, they did not have the law on their side. The acting governor of Michigan demanded that the Blackburns be extradited back to the United States to stand trial for inciting a riot and for the attempted murder of Sheriff Wilson. So the Blackburns were taken into custody in Canada, and they remained in custody for the rest of the summer, while Canadian officials deliberated the case. The Blackburns were not set free until August, when the Lieutenant Governor of Upper Canada, Sir John Colborne, denied Governor Mason's demand for extradition. The Blackburns eventually settled in Toronto. They didn't want to take any chances in Windsor. Thankfully, the country of Canada has honored the Blackburns with historic plaques in the city of Toronto. A few years later, the Lightfoots, the Frenches, and the Willoughbys organized another bold plan. They and others withdrew from First Baptist Church of Detroit, where they were not permitted to serve on church committees nor allowed to sit in the main sanctuary because they were Black. They formed their own congregation, which became Second Baptist Church. Members of Second Baptist met in the French's home on Beaubien and St. Antoine until the first church was built. Their first minister, Reverend William Monroe, was appointed in 1840. Acutely aware of the needs of people escaping from slavery by the hundreds, Second Baptist members reached out to churches in Canada and formed the Baptist Association for Colored People with two Baptist churches in Canada. The Detroit African American community continued to grow in the 1840s. Two new residents, William Lambert and George DeBaptiste, became the masterminds of Detroit's Underground Railroad network for the next 20 years. Lambert was born free in Trenton, New Jersey. He was educated in Quaker schools, and he became a skilled tailor. He cemented himself into the Detroit Black community by marrying Julia, one of the Willoughby's daughters. George DeBaptiste was born free in Virginia. He became a barber and served as a steward on an Ohio River steamboat before he left to go to Madison, Indiana. In Madison, Indiana, he joined an active Underground Railroad rescue operation. But when one of Madison's Underground Railroad conductors was murdered, DeBaptiste packed up and moved to Detroit. His family joined Second Baptist Church, and DeBaptiste continued to work as a barber, but also as a clothing salesman, and later he owned a bakery. In 1850, DeBaptiste purchased a steamboat. However, Blacks were not permitted to get a license to operate such a vessel, so he hired a white captain to operate his boat. His steamboat ran from Detroit to Sandusky, and in between, it made two stops in Canada ports at Wallaceburg and Amherstburg. In addition to typical freight that steamboats carry, the Baptiste steamboat carried former enslaved people from Detroit to the Canadian ports. William Lambert was nicknamed President of Detroit's Underground Railroad, and DeBaptiste was second in command. Now, the records from Second Baptist Church today claim that church members assisted some 5,000 freedom seekers to escape from slavery. But Lambert and DeBaptiste's operation exceeded the capacity of Second Baptist Church. So they created a new organization, which they called the Colored Vigilant Committee. The CVC included individuals from many occupations in Detroit and from other churches. And although the CVC had white allies who helped them, Lambert and DeBaptiste thought it would best serve secrecy for the CVC to remain a Black-only organization. Altogether, some 60 to 70 Detroiters participated in the efforts of the CVC. Many were members of Second Baptist Church, but some were members of Bethel AME Church, and some were members of First Congregational Church, as well as the Prince Hall Masons. Lambert estimated that in its 20-year operation from the 1840s to 1860, the CVC raised over $120,000 to assist thousands of destitute freedom seekers. Now, I am told that if you want to know how much $120,000 is in today's money, multiply that by 30. I'll let you do the math. One extraordinary freedom seeker reached Detroit in 1841 after escaping from Kentucky four different times and being recaptured each time. His name was Henry Bibb, and he was destined to make a mark on the anti-slavery movement nationwide. Everybody remembers Harriet Tubman. New York had Harriet Tubman. Detroit had Henry Bibb. Henry Bibb was enslaved in Kentucky from birth. He worked as a house slave due to his physical appearance. He, his mother, and his brothers were mixed race because his mother was sexually exploited by her enslavers. Henry suffered a series of crushing brutalities and abuses in slavery, including being almost starved to death, the surprise sale of his two younger brothers, and having to watch the enslaver beat his wife. After he watched his wife being beaten, and after finding bruises on his daughter's face and body that the enslaver's wife said were normal, Henry decided that he couldn't take it anymore. He made up his mind that he had to run away. But before running away, he promised his wife, Melinda, that he would come back for her and their daughter. And he did. He went back for his wife and daughter four times. But each time he was recaptured. After his fifth escape, he dared not go back. All his attempts to reach Melinda and baby Francis had failed. But instead of living a life of bitterness and depression, he turned his failure into a life devoted to helping fugitives and to undermining slavery. Henry Bibb attended classes that Reverend Monroe taught at Second Baptist Church. He became a speaker for the Michigan Anti-Slavery Society. Newspapers reported that when Bibb spoke about his life in slavery, people in the audience wept. Bibb wrote articles for anti-slavery newspapers such as Frederick Douglass's paper and William Lloyd Garrison's Emancipator. And in 1849, he wrote his autobiography, Narrative of the Life and Adventures of Henry Bibb, an American Slave. And because of what he revealed in his narrative, his enslaver located him and demanded his return to Kentucky. When the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 was passed, hundreds of fugitives who had settled in Detroit left Detroit and moved to Canada. 84 members of Second Baptist Church moved to Canada in 1 week. And the congregation of St. Matthew's Episcopal Church was decimated. Henry Bibb had to escape to Canada, too. In Canada, Bibb was no longer afraid of being captured, so his anti-slavery endeavors intensified. he and his free wife, Mary, started Canada's first black newspaper, Voice of the Fugitive. Bibb would meet boats coming to Windsor from Detroit and write stories based on interviews that he conducted with the once enslaved people as they took their first steps on free Canadian soil. One day in September of 1852, as Bibb approached two young men coming from Detroit, he recognized them. They were his brothers, George and John, whom he had not seen since the day they were sold. In Canada, Mrs. Bibb started a school for once enslaved children, and the Bibbs helped freedom seekers secure food, shelter, clothing, and work. Along with friends from Detroit, Henry Bibb created the Refugee Home Society to raise money to make loans available to the refugees so that they could buy their own land in Canada. With so much important Underground Railroad and anti-slavery activity going on in the Detroit, Canada region, the place was bound to attract the attention of well-known abolitionists. Two of the most famous 19th century abolitionists to visit Detroit were Frederick Douglass and John Brown. The first to arrive was John Brown, the revolutionary abolitionist who had already earned a reputation in Kansas as a freedom fighter who was willing to use violence to defend his positions. Unfortunately, Henry Bibb was no longer alive when Brown came to Detroit in 1859. But Brown was not a stranger to Detroit. He was born in Ohio, and he had come to Detroit as a young boy with his father on business from Ohio. In 1859, Brown came to Detroit after liberating a group of 12 enslaved people from Missouri at gunpoint. They traveled on horseback in December through Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa, then by train to Chicago, and finally to Detroit. But months before this rescue, Brown had met with Harriet Tubman and Martin Delaney, and Harriet Tubman had agreed to join him on the raid he was planning in Virginia. Like Brown and Tubman, Martin Delaney was another uncompromising African-American abolitionist who had moved to Canada. Delaney was a radical who did not see eye to eye with Frederick Douglass, but everyone knew that for Brown's plan to work, Douglass's endorsement was absolutely necessary. At an 1858 convention in Canada, Brown revealed his plan. His plan was to destabilize slavery by making guerrilla-style raids on farms in Virginia to liberate enslaved people, recruit some of the men to join his militia in the mountains, and train them to continue making guerrilla raids on farms to liberate more people, recruit more men, to grow the militia's force. Two Detroiters attended Brown's convention in Chatham, Canada. The two people from Detroit who attended this convention that Brown had in Chatham, Canada, were Reverend William Monroe, the pastor of Second Baptist Church, and William Lambert. And this third photo here is Martin Delaney, a very important African-American of the 19th century but he doesn't get the recognition that Frederick Douglass got. After Brown left Canada, he went back to Kansas, where he liberated those 12 enslaved people. When he made it to Detroit with them and saw them safely on board a vessel leaving Detroit for Canada, he went to the home of William Webb, where the Detroit abolitionists were hosting the most important man of the time, Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass had spoken earlier that day at the Detroit City Hall. In this meeting at William Webb's home, Brown revealed even more of his plans for the raid. Now his plan included raiding the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry. When that was revealed, all hell broke loose again. Frederick Douglass called Brown's plan a perfect steel trap. And sparks flew between Douglass and Brown. Brown defended his plan, and he embarrassed Douglass by implying that he was a coward. One of Brown's associates at the meeting, Richard Ralph, intervened to mediate the conflict between Brown and Douglass. But Douglass stood firm, contending that he would not support Brown's plan. And Brown was unmovable. He would not abandon this strategy. For months after the Detroit meeting, Brown continued to write to Douglass, pleading for his support. A few weeks before the raid, Douglass and Brown met again secretly in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. But Douglass stood firm. He argued that attacking the arsenal was not an attack on individual slave owners. It was an attack on the federal government. And that kind of attack would inflame the whole country against them. Brown was deeply disappointed that he never got Douglass's support, but he had come to believe unequivocally that only violence could force the country to end slavery. We all know how the raid at Harper's Ferry ended. October 16th, 1859 is the date of Brown's epic defeat. Brown and his men were either killed by the U.S. military that day or captured like Brown and hanged after brief trials. But historians agree October 16, 1859 was the beginning of the bloody end of American slavery. On December 2, 1859, as Brown walked to the gallows to be hung, he handed the guard a note that read, "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done." Thank you for listening. That is the end.
Thank you so much for that, Ms. Tucker. Dr. Tucker. It's always pleasant to hear your knowledge of history. It's always so overwhelming because there is so much history and we can't learn everything in our lifetime. But this is the importance of books and why all books should remain free.
They should not be banned.
And accessible, right? I see we have a hand up.
Hi. I have a question for you, ma'am. The woman who changed places in the jail with the veil, what happened to the one who was in disguise, who was taking her place? What happened to her?
Her name was Caroline French. And the jailers officials in Detroit tried to have her be replaced, have her be a replacement for Lucy Blackburn, but she was a free woman. And there was no doubt about her freedom. And so they could not keep her. They had to let her go.
And they didn't try to make an example of her or anything? Or?
They tried to, but they couldn't because she was absolutely free. Everybody knew that. She had been in the city for a long time. So they let her go, but they were mad enough to try it.
Oh, yeah, they looked like fools. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's a good question.
Thank you all so much for joining us. See you next time. Have a great day.
And, of course, thank you to the African American Association, the Office of Student Activities, and Dr. Vita Smith Tucker for allowing us to bring you that presentation here on today's WHFR Journal. It happened in Detroit. Amazing Underground Railroad stories. That's all we have time for on our program today. Do stay tuned. Kitty Love up next. Highway 61 Blues kicks off your Friday afternoon here on WHFR. From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR. WHFR Dearborn at 89.3, online at WHFR.FM, making waves. Have a great week. We'll be back next Friday afternoon with another edition of the WHFR Journal.
The Palace Theater proudly presents that new violin virtuoso, Jack Benny, and special added attraction, that sensational new invention, the Magic Lantern.
Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad, the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, and it makes a man watchful and a little lonely.
For a laugh or a thrill and a hint of classic smooth jazz, it's Radio Vault Special Edition, Tuesdays, 10 a.m. to 1 o'clock, here on WHFR 89.3, the station making waves in your mind.